This is Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. As usual, we shall explore the realm of finance and digital and, of course, business. Because Malaysia's push into digital banking is indeed gathering pace. The central bank's decision to issue up to 5 digital bank licenses in the first quarter of next year generated considerable interest from consumers and investors. In fact, on this show, we've had multiple interviews of those that are applying for that digital banking license. So to top this off, the excitement around this is coupled with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general and has continued to rise with more than 1 billion ringgit of digital assets stored on behalf of more than 300 consumers and customers, processing more than 4.2 billion ringgit for this year to date. This is, of course, indicating a positive trend of crypto demand in Malaysia. Some items coming in from PwC in their research does show that over 3 in 4 Malaysians, or 74% of Malaysians, are interested in becoming a consumer of a virtual bank. Respondents are aged between 55 and above are twice more likely to be interested in virtual banks due to what they call a bad experience with their current bank. Now, on top of this, we shall explore on the idea of what do businesses need to do to transform their financial landscape and ensure that they won't be lagging behind. How can we build a more sustainable financial ecosystem that creates value and contributes towards a stable financial ecosystem, particularly in a landscape where we are moving towards an endemic situation of COVID-19? Well, to answer all this question, I have with me, joining us online, is Dr. Anila Munro, the Professor of Economics at Asia School of Business in partnership with MIT Sloan Management. She joins us from Vancouver. Anila, maybe we can explore a little bit better about how the digital banks are expected to transform the way consumers and businesses operate in Malaysia. What do you think will be some of the key benefits and challenges following this transformation?
Well, I think looking at other countries, China, of course, is a great example and is well ahead in digital banking. That either there are unfilled gaps, often consumer lending or micro, small, medium enterprise lending, that if they're not well served, the digital banks are often in a great position to fill that niche, and that's been extraordinarily successful in China. And then I think on the other hand, it's just really modernizing banking, moving more to digital and providing new, more accessible, convenient services for people, for businesses. So a combination of the two.
We also want to understand a little bit better about the regulations that are needed to ensure some form of successful implementation of digital banks in Malaysia. From the players that I spoke to, they're very interested in enhancing or expounding their capabilities in privacy, in cybersecurity, in trying to understand better how the consumers can be better served, but most importantly, to try to remain profitable. That's the key factor in issuing the licenses from the central bank. How do you think this can be done? Can the market catch up with the requirements of a successful implementation of digital bank in Malaysia?
Well, I think BNM is very, Bank Negara Malaysia is very thorough, and in their report, they've really covered the whole landscape of, obviously they want profitability because they don't want to issue licenses and have banks fail shortly afterwards. But all of the usual things that they do all the time in terms of licensing, banks, payment services providers, they want to see good governance, they want to see risk management, they want to see financial backing, they want to see good cybersecurity, IT systems, they want to, and the good governance, they want to see good conduct, and which has been sort of an issue in a number of countries, most recently Australia, but there have been a number of cases in many countries before that. So I think, the document that BNM have put out really covers the ground and sets a high bar, which is great. I think the existing regulations, they're well-versed in that, and much of the same applies. I think in this case, though, maybe there are some new aspects, which is maybe why there's sort of a 3 to 5 year, slightly simpler regulations to see if the existing ones really fit the new models. Right. And so front of mind with that might be big tech coming into the banking sector, which creates a whole new set of challenges around data privacy. Once you Google knows everything about every email I sent, every website I ever visited. And then to combine that with financial data and what walls do you put between, it's something that China's really working hard on now in terms of putting firewalls between and dealing with data privacy, which really becomes a big challenge in that environment. So that's just one example of, you know, these new models, we don't know yet what they're gonna be and what the additional challenges are.
You know, it's interesting that you draw the comparison between China and the US in terms of big tech. In fact, both nations are indeed cracking down on how big tech is being done in respective countries. Their reach, of course, is global. Do you feel that smaller players in small countries like Malaysia can actually stand a chance against this big tech entering or encroaching their businesses and, of course, encroaching their influence in how we do our day-to-day? Just a quick example, you're right, Google knows everything. But, of course, you know, when it comes to Apple, for instance, or other Android devices, they just, it's very pervasive. How do you step away from all this, knowing that, you know, it's better for us to be digitally connected, particularly in, you know, an endemic situation. We want our financial inclusivity to be done. But at the same time, big tech is just around. So do you feel that we have what it takes to not just stack up against the big players from those two nations, but of course, locally as well? Does the regulation or regulatory bodies in Malaysia have that wherewithal in terms of managing the kind of expected problems that might arise following the inclusivity from digital banking industry?
I think different countries have handled it different ways. For example, India has their unified payments interface. And on that, actually, the biggest players involve big tech, but they're a minority stake by regulation, right? So they've come in, they're providing the tech, they're helping move everything forward, but they're a minority stake in those big providers. I think another aspect of regulation that comes into play is interoperability, that you don't want big tech coming in and having a whole lot of different platforms and fragmenting the whole system. And so something that Thailand did some time ago, well, probably a couple of years before Malaysia, but Malaysia has done as well, is to have that common QR code for the system, which gives interoperability and generates competition and prevents fragmentation. And the Thais were very explicit about really not coming out and having foreign big tech coming in and taking over the system because there was already a common basis for competing, right? And that's been an issue in China as well, which is part of why China wants to have you don't need a central bank digital currency to do that. That's maybe the path China's taking, but it's again that common interface and common platform that everybody's competing on makes a really big difference.
We'll go for one short break before we continue our conversation with Dr. Anila Munro of Asia School of Business. We'll be right back after these messages. This is Notepad. I have with me Dr. Anila Munro, Professor of Economics at the Asia School of Business, dialing in from Vancouver, actually. So, Anila, we did touch a little bit on Project Dunbar. And of course, this brings together a bunch of central banks, the Reserve Bank of Australia, Bank Negara Malaysia, MAS, Monetary Authority of Singapore, South African Reserve Bank with the Bank of International Settlements. You did touch a little bit more about how they are working to test the use of central bank digital currencies or CBDCs. And this is, of course, the idea here is to test it against international settlements. And, of course, the technical prototypes of the shared platforms developed in collaboration with different partners was tested at the Singapore FinTech Festival. There are still things that are, you know, unearthed, particularly following this. And because of many issues still is wrapped around the issue of sustainability, of energy usage, of all these other items that are is associated with crypto, including who the actors in terms of the users of this particular technology. There's hype for digital currency usage now. How can we build a more, first of all, sustainable financial ecosystem that creates value towards contributing towards a stable financial system? But of course, the second is, how do we ensure that people that are not malicious actors that can use this? We're trying to understand how financial inclusivity can allow for better, transparent use of these kind of services.
So there's a lot in that question. Let me start with the energy footprint. So when people think crypto, they think Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is sort of one of three kind of classes, as I think of it, as of cryptocurrency. And there's a trade-off between decentralization, security, and scalability. And for financial and payments, we want security. That's a given, right? So we're either going to give up some decentralization or we're going to give up some scalability. In payments, it's actually really hard to give up the scalability. So Bitcoin does about, 30,000 transactions a day or something. But during Singles Day in China, we're talking hundreds of thousands a second. So Bitcoin's environmental footprint is already as much electricity as I think people used to say Finland, and now it's got to be Sweden. So you just can't scale that up for payments. It's just not the right model. So you have to give up some of that decentralization for scalability. And that class then of cryptocurrency is called permissioned blockchain models, right? And so that would include all of the central bank digital currency projects, all of the stable coins. For the stable coins, you have to give up some decentralization because you really need to control the supply of coins so that you can keep the price stable. So all of those are in the more permissioned blockchain space, which have a much lower environmental footprint. Bitcoins is so big because it's so decentralized. You need extra security around the whole thing because everybody can access it, but also it's this proof of work kind of consensus algorithm that just is very energy intensive. So this Bitcoin is a volatile crypto asset. It's designed to be price volatile because the supply changes very slowly. So all of the changes in demand go into price. And that's fine. That's a speculative asset for people who want to hold it, who have the balance sheet that they can bear the risk, and that's fine. But it's not really what we're talking about with payments and a lot of other financial services. So in the permissioned blockchain space, I mean, it's not like it has no environmental footprint because all of these data centers and so on have an increasing environmental footprint. But then that comes back to, where does the electricity come from? Is it coal or is it, solar or wind? So that's the environmental one. In terms of inclusivity, there's a lot of hype around crypto and blockchain. It's something that you want to use if you want to work with other people and you need to keep a record of everything and you don't have sensitive information that needs to be exchanged, then it can be good. But once you have sensitive information, you want that probably off the blockchain because of the transparency of it. And if you don't need that immutable record, then probably it's cumbersome for what it is, right? But for other applications, it's a wonderful new efficient technology. It's not the answer to everything, right? And in terms of inclusivity, the explosion of digital financial services has already been wonderful, I think, for financial inclusion in many countries, India, China. There are many other examples, Kenya with mobile money. And you don't need crypto necessarily for that. There are a lot of projects that aim for financial inclusion that include crypto that could just as easily be done without. Technology that fits the use. It's not the answer to everything, but it's a fantastic new technology that will change the way a lot of people do things. Right. And you can think in industry, there are wonderful applications where, you know, you have a supply chain that really needs good communication and needs to be able to transact both, you know, information and value, probably within a fairly closed system. So again, we're in the permission blockchain, not the fully decentralized Bitcoin model that can really revolutionize the way things are done.
Let's talk a little bit more about the masterclass that you did, which is on digital currencies. On building a resilient and inclusive financial ecosystem. What were the kind of lessons that you got from those kind of events? Do you feel that you learned more than what you shared, actually? What would be the learnings from that event?
Well, I think you always learn by listening to what other people say, and you always learn by preparing. As a teacher, you know, people always say, if you want to really learn your subject, then you better teach it, because you really deepen your learning by teaching and trying to simplify it and make it accessible to other people. I guess, you know, for me, I teach a class in payments and digital currencies. And this event, because it's leadership and sustainability in Asia conference, it really forced me to think a little bit more about the ESG, environmental, social, governance. And on the governance side, I think we get a lot more into financial stability is and also good KYC, anti-money laundering, and so on. We want our financial system to make it easy for everybody to manage their money and have convenient services, but we don't want to make it too available for illegal activity.
Got it.
Which ultimately hurts people.
Got it. One more break before we continue our conversation with Dr. Nela Munro of the Asia School of Business. We'll be right back after these messages. I have with me Dr. Nela Munro, Professor of Economics at Asia School of Business. Let's zoom in down to Malaysian businesses. What do businesses in this country need to know in order to successfully, I guess, migrate or adopt the new evolving financial landscape? I'm not just talking about crypto per se, but of course, digital currencies. I'm talking about digital payments. How do you think businesses can adapt and adopt these changes?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say my background is central banking and education. It's not business. But I think, you know, these new services, like anywhere in the world, Malaysia has strong uptake in some areas and weaker uptake in others. I can think of some services, businesses I interact with, which either only take cash or do a lot of cumbersome printing out and stapling and so on. So I think it's quite mixed, but when these new services are available, I mean, I think it's also an opportunity sometimes for businesses to transform themselves in their own, because businesses typically have their own digital transformation strategies. It's I think the management of that is probably the biggest issue. One of my colleagues, you mentioned the LESA conference that happened last week. There was also a masterclass by one of my colleagues, Loredana Paduan, who talked about digital transformation really from the management side. So how do you navigate it? Well, first you want to do why you're doing it. So the why and then the how, but really the most challenging part in her experience is the people culture side. It's typically involving, as it is with central bank digital currency projects, it involves really very diverse teams that need to collaborate. You've got, you know, the business side, you've got the financial people, you've got the technical people, the cybersecurity, and they really all speak different languages, but need to come together and really build solutions together. And often it's change for people, and, you know, some people love change, some people hate it. And really managing that in the business is probably...
I think your colleague did strike a chord. why are we doing this, right? Because sometimes people are getting excited over the hype without knowing the objective of the game. I think one of the key elements, of course, is trying to stay afloat, at least for many of the businesses, not just in Malaysia, but around the world as well. But moving forward, you feel that this is an opportunity, not just for businesses, but perhaps for governments, perhaps for economics, economists like yourselves. Do you feel that this could be an opportunity for us to explore even further on this? Or, you know, this is just yet another hype that we can get over with? You know, I'm not bullish on crypto at all. I don't understand it, and I'm trying to understand it. But I feel that there's so much more asset classes that I need to explore first before I jump into this. Do you feel that that's the vibe getting from some of us, or there is general euphoria, I suppose, when it comes to
new currencies? Yeah, I think there's a lot of hype because it's something new, but actually what's really transformed our lives is a lot of the things that don't have hype. You know, when I grew up, I had a little passbook I took to the bank, and it was open banking hours, you know, office hours during the week, and you needed to go and get your cash. Then there was an ATM, and with my children, I used to give them notes and coins for pocket money, and they got to sort of adolescent age and said, oh, Mom, you know, we like getting pocket money, but please, no notes and coins. Can you just put it in our bank accounts? And, you know, one of them is a late teens, got her first tax rebate check, had no idea what it is. I had to explain to her what's a check. I mean, we've really moved forward. I anticipate I'm going to, you know, tell my grandchildren these notes and coins, what they were. And
Some
of them were quite pretty, but why would you do that?
I had that very strange conversation. No, because, you know, my youngest, she's 7, she said, wouldn't it be good if telephones had lines on it so that we don't lose our phones? And how do I tell her that, you know, it's a very strange world. She didn't know what a telephone book is. Why would she know, right? So, I don't know. I wish you all the best in terms of trying to get us all at least understand a little bit on crypto. I've had Luno on. I've had one or two other players that have been sanctioned by the Securities Commission on. But yet, I've still made that move. Do you have that notion that 2022 might be a little bit different when it comes to market acceptance in crypto adoption amongst Malaysians?
Well, I mean, Wendy, it comes back to the why. So there's a nice paper by Antoinette Shore and a co-author at MIT. They look at actually who owns crypto, and it's mostly educated, male and young. So that's fine. But it's not the answer for everybody. And yeah, I know that the asset managers are starting to get into it, and they might say something like 1% of your portfolio for somebody who wants some risk. Yeah, there could be for Bitcoin because its supply is so fixed, a bit of an inflation hedge, but probably still a risky asset that doesn't perform well in bad times. So do people want to hold that? You know, personally, I think there's still hurdles for people. It's a risky thing, so you really want to take risk. And I have to say, I'm not in the business of giving financial advice, but if you directly engage with Bitcoin, you have a private key and a public key, and if you lose your keys, that's it. You've lost your tokens, right? Their tokens are ownership by possession, and if you can't show possession, there's no reset my password. So you can go through an exchange, but the exchanges are actually the weak point because everything's secure within the blockchain. But once you go out of that into the exchange, that's where all the hacking attacks happen. And some of the Malaysia's done a very good job of regulating the exchanges in 2019. I can't remember the numbers, but there were maybe a score of the exchanges that were cut down to a handful because of the Securities Commission looking very carefully at you know, consumer protection and risk and so on. So crypto, like Bitcoin, is still, it's a risky asset for people who have the balance sheet and then the appetite for it.
I do not have the balance sheet, nor do I have the appetite for it. I do believe that, you know, the idea here is, of course, the why. I can't answer that for myself, but that's me.
Crypto more generally, Bitcoin is a very sort of extreme boundary version of crypto. And there's a lot of crypto that, and especially industry applications of crypto managing election, voting records, health records potentially, although that's sensitive information, you need some off blockchain, but managing supply chain, shipping, logistics. There are a lot of great business applications for blockchain technology, which I think is actually probably more interesting, but yeah, outside the hype.
Well, there's a lot to explore. But Ottanella, we have to draw this conversation to a close. I will get you back in the studio once you're back in KL. But that was Dr. Anila Munro, the Professor of Economics at Asia School of Business. If you've missed any part of this interview, just head on to astro120.com. Look for Notepad over there. You can also look for ASB, or the Asia School of Business. Until then, thanks very much for watching and goodbye.